Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ethan Besser-Frederick, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Brian Stauffer about his new book, Victory on Earth or in Heaven. So, Brian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really excited to be a part of it.
I was wondering if you could help us start this interview by just telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So, my background, of course, is in Mexican history. I did an MA at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque and a PhD at the University of Texas at Austin, studying under Matthew Butler, who's a historian of 20th century church-state conflict in Mexico. Did my dissertation on the so-called Religionero Rebellion in Mexico. Took place during the presidency of Sebastián Lerdo de Tejada in the 1870s, and really trying to figure out not only tell the sort of complete story of this revolt, but also try to find out what kind of motivated it, what was going on behind the scenes, etc. I'm now actually, I've sort of left academia, or at least I'm sort of in the alt-ac world. I work as the translator and curator of the Spanish collection at the Texas General Land Office. The land office in Texas has a cache of records from the time when Texas was part of New Spain and then part of Mexico. And those records form what we call the Spanish collection. And so I'm sort of in charge of that collection, do a lot of translation work, but also some sort of academic work as well. Working on some book projects and things like that. So that's sort of my background and what I've been up to.
So if I can ask, how did you land on this topic or this sort of lesser known rebellion in particular?
Sure. Yeah. So it was, I think, like a lot of historical research, it was sort of a happy accident. I was an MA student at the University of New Mexico. I was in Michoacán, in Morelia, Michoacán. I had gone there looking for evidence of especially indigenous, but sort of popular engagement with liberalism. That was kind of the big topic at the time. Florencia Mallon's book had come out, and I was very, very enthusiastic about that book. And so I was sort of interested in finding out. I had also read this book by Eduardo Ruiz, this 19th century Michoacano, who'd written a book about the intervention, the French intervention in Michoacán. And he'd mentioned the participation of some indigenous people in the town of Zitácuaro, and tried to sort of figure out why they had gotten involved in the liberal cause against Maximilian. And so I had gone to Michoacán to try to find evidence about that story, but to try to flesh that out about indigenous involvement in the intervention. And I really didn't find much when I got there. And instead, I happened upon these books at the State Archive of Michoacán, known as the Hijuelas books, which are collections of correspondence, mostly having to do with the subdivision of indigenous communal lands in Michoacán in the 19th century. All of it stemming from the 1856 Ley Lerdo, right, that mandated the subdivision of indigenous communal lands. So it's an absolutely fantastic collection, and by the way, it's being digitized completely right now under a grant that I was involved with. So those will be available for the whole world to see one day. But anyway, I was there. I'd stumbled upon these books, and I thought, well, this is a really fascinating different avenue I can take. And I chose a community, and almost at random, not totally at random, but I chose a community that I thought I could tackle in an MA thesis. So I chose the community of Cualcomán. The Hijuelas books are organized by district. And so I chose the district of Cualcomán, which has several different indigenous communities in it. And I started following the story of how the communal lands were broken up. And what I found very quickly was that in Cualcomán, I'd happened upon one of the more conflictive cases of land division, in which indigenous comuneros, or at least a faction of them, actually went into active revolt over this issue of the subdivision of communal lands. The way it was done was frankly fraudulent in some aspects. And what I found was that these indigenous comuneros, the ones who had revolted against the local government, actually made common cause with another set of rebels who were operating in the area, rebels under the leadership of this guy, Bonifacio Vaca. And when I started digging around a little more, I found out that this was a religionero chief, and I had never heard of this revolt before. So I was just sort of really interested, got really interested then in trying to figure out, flesh out this story, figure out who the religioneros were, why they revolted against the government, etc. And I found almost no help in the historiography. There's really very little written about them. And what has been written about them is fairly dismissive most of the time. And so I didn't end up pursuing that for the MA. I actually did go on to write an MA about communal land disentailment in Cualcomán. But I knew that it's something I wanted to revisit at the doctoral level. And so, in fact, during that trip to Morelia, I actually contacted Matthew Butler at UT Austin and said, hey, have you heard of these religioneros? And he said, I've run across that stuff too, and I've always been interested. This would be a great, you know, PhD topic. And that's sort of how the whole thing got started.
Those surprises in the archive are always very fun. And I think the best projects come out of that. Your book picks this up, and the first line of the introduction is "When I Was Hooked," because it tells us that this book is a story of ordinary Catholic men and women who were simultaneously challenging secular radicalization and Catholic modernization. How can there be a Catholic rebellion against Catholicism?
That's a great question. And I think it's hard for us to wrap our heads around because we're so used to thinking in terms, in these sort of monolithic terms about church and state, especially in Latin America, especially in Mexico, which has probably the most conflictual church-state history in all of Latin America. So we kind of default to this idea about, well, there's this epic battle between church and state in Mexico in the 19th century. And on one side, we have Juarez and we have his liberals. And on the other side, we have these kind of these sort of arch reactionary Catholics aligned with the papacy, maybe. And what I began to find when I started digging into this a bit more was it's much more complicated than that. I had known that the Mexican literature on the church has gotten very, very good, has developed a lot over the last couple of decades. So there's a lot of scholars, particularly in Mexico, who are doing a lot of sort of disaggregating of the church as a institution or as a category, finding all these different layers. So that was one avenue to pursue. But once I started actually researching at the local level, or especially at the diocesan level, so in the archive of the Diocese of Zamora, and in the archive at what's called the Casa Morelos, which is where the Archdiocese of Michoacán's archive is located. It was actually appropriated by the state during the revolution. What I found when I started looking at the parish level was that there were all kinds of conflicts going on within parishes between Catholics. And that shouldn't surprise us again if we understand Catholicism as this very broad umbrella, and that there are many, many different tendencies or kinds of Catholicism within it. But what really struck me was the level of conflict, particularly at this time, between these different factions within Catholicism at the local level. And these factions I designated, well, on the one hand, the Ultramontanes, who are aligned with this more modernizing, reformist, restorationist project that's being really diffused into Michoacán by a couple of key players, including relatives of the Archbishop of Mexico. And then on the other side, what I call the Baroque Catholics. And these are, they tend to be more popular. They tend to be more indigenous and Afro-Mestizo. And they are partisans of a more collective and a more exuberant and a more externally oriented kind of religion. And so you see that this conflict really does have a lot to do with the ways that different people in different communities responded to the challenge of the Lerdista anti-clericalism. And so I felt it important to try to get beyond this sort of church-state narrative and try to dig a little bit more into what was happening within the church itself and within Catholicism.
Which is a very provocative task at hand to talk about not only the nuances within the Catholic community, but also the conflicts between them. And then also, as you point out, of course, almost all of the radical secularizers are Catholic themselves, which often gets left out of the story. So go ahead.
I was gonna say that's absolutely right. And I think probably to be fair, I would like to have developed this a bit more, but I think in my view, there's really three main lines of Catholicism in Mexico at the time of the Reliquionary Revolt. We have the Ultramontanes, we have the Baroques, but we also have liberal Catholicism, what's been called Enlightened Catholicism in other circles, maybe Federalist Catholicism. They all branch off of the same stem. But essentially, you're right, that most of the radical reformers, even the most radical of them, are Catholics as well. They just have a different vision of what Catholicism is. They want to strip it back to something they see as more democratic, that was present in the early church. They want to make it more sort of obedient or subservient to the state, things like that. So there really is, I think, these three kind of main branches of Catholicism, and it's really important to see how they interact with each other if you want to understand something like the Reliquionary Revolt.
So in your first chapter, you take all three of these different Catholicisms, as well as the small minority of atheists and Protestants and other groups, and you cover the whole life cycle of the revolt, from its antecedents to how the revolt played out to then how it's incorporated into the Porfiriato period. Could you walk us through that timeline kind of briefly that you cover in your first chapter, just especially for any listeners that maybe don't know what Lerdismo is or the terms we've been throwing around?
Yeah, sure. So the genesis of the revolt really is the 1873 incorporation of the so-called laws of reform into the Constitution of Mexico. The laws of reform were really kind of wartime measures. If listeners are familiar with the Reforma period at all, they'll know that during the Reforma, during the wars, Benito Juarez's government, sometimes while it was in exile, issued these laws that were really fairly, that attempted really to finally and definitively separate church and state, to sort of put the church in its place under the state, and in some ways to sort of punish the church for its involvement in conservative rebellions and movements and things like that. So this included prohibitions on public worship, which was kind of the major issue that I look at in the book. That is to say that religious acts must be performed within church walls, not outside. And anyone who's been to Mexico or other parts of Latin America know how important processions are and other public religious festivals and festivities are to the religious culture there. So that was one of the major ones. There's also the nationalization of church property that's not being used directly for the cult. There are prohibitions on religious brotherhoods and things like that. So this was a very serious set of anti-clerical measures. But again, were kind of wartime measures at the time when Benito Juarez's government issued them between 1859 and 1861. Flash forward past the intervention, when Lerdo de Tejada comes to power after Juarez's death, he kind of makes makes it his main task to sort of consolidate that, the gains of the Reforma and the gains of the laws of reform in particular. And so his main project then is to incorporate these laws into the Constitution, make them permanent. Part of what came along with that as well is an idea that we're no longer going to tolerate any kind of half measures or any local
flexibility when it comes to the actual enforcement of these laws of reform. Benito Juarez's government was fairly flexible and allowed people, especially at the local level. For example, local officials could give the green light for processions to happen as long as they, you know, had gotten word of it and things like that. But Laredo's government really takes a very strong stance against that kind of flexibility. They want this to actually be uniformly enforced. And so the laws of reform are incorporated into the Constitution, at least nominally in 1873. And then there's an actual law called the Ley Orgánica in 1874 that establishes the mechanisms by which those laws will be made enforceable nationwide. And that's when you start to see the first of these revolts. And the first of the revolts tend to be in indigenous communities. They tend to be anti-Protestant revolts. And I should go back a step here and say that the laws of reform also officially declared the separation of church and state, which meant that the very old tradition of Catholic exclusivity in Mexico was overturned. And that allowed for Protestant proselytizers for the first time to come to Mexico openly. And in fact, Lerdo de Tejada had actually met with a group of Protestant missionaries from the U.S. and sort of welcomed them to the country. What you see is that these early revolts are often anti-Protestant revolts. They're literally people rising up against either their local authorities, accusing them of being Protestants, or in the case of Abaluco in Jalisco, there were actually a couple of Protestant converts and a Protestant minister who were massacred in these kind of anti-Protestant uprisings. So you see that sort of happen in late 1873. In 1874, you actually start to see, in the early part of 1874, you start to see the formation of small gavillas, what I call. These are small religionero bands, essentially. They start out in the very, you know, with very small numbers, 5, 10, 15 men, mostly men, although there were some women involved in this movement. And then they grow very strongly over the next year and a half, especially in response to the different steps that were taken to actually to begin to enforce the laws of reform, including, for example, the exclaustration of the Hermanas de la Caridad, which was a religious corporation involved with healthcare mostly. So they were not, it was decreed that they were not allowed to continue to skirt the laws of reform by living in community and by dressing in their clerical garb. And so they were forced to either leave the community or leave the country, essentially, which many of them did. And so these kind of turning points created a lot more agitation in the countryside. And the religionero gavillas in Michoacán began to grow really, really strongly in that period, especially in the northwest part, in the what's now the district of Jiquilpan, and in central Michoacán, in a lot of communities in what was then the Puruandiro district. And so these gavillas grow really big. The state government of Michoacán at the beginning tries to sort of downplay the threat and keeps saying that these are just a bunch of sort of holdouts from the Maximilian period. They're no big deal. And it mobilizes National Guard units, which your listeners may have read about in other works on popular liberalism, to try to stamp them out. And nothing really works. And in fact, they begin to grow more and more strong, especially by the time of the early 1875. And so by that point, the state government has to actually admit that things are spiraling out of control, and it asks for federal intervention. And the Lerdista government does provide that. It sends federal troops, and then in the low thousands, really, into Michoacán, and increasingly takes this kind of scorched earth kind of approach to the rebellion that ends up alienating a whole lot of people all over the political spectrum, and is never really able to get much of a handle on it. In late 1875 and early 1876, the Porfirian movement, the revolution of Tuxtepec gets underway. The government is having a bit more success against the religioneros by way of this process they call indulto, whereby they would provide these kind of battlefield pardons for people. So those two factors cause the religioneros, one, that Diaz now is offering a new movement in which they can sort of put themselves under, right? And the other tendency, which is this new battlefield pardon kind of approach of the state government, of the federal government rather, causes the Rioconeros to decide that they'll go with Porfirio Diaz. And so that's the kind of main trajectory of the revolt. I cover this in the last chapter, but in 1876 and 1877, what happens is that the Rioconeros partner, a lot of the big ones partner with Diaz. They form part of his Tuxtepec coalition. But then after he comes to power, he sort of quietly begins to get rid of them, either by co-opting them or by actually assassinating them. And so that's in a nutshell, the kind of trajectory of the revolt.
Well, I would say that was a very good brief summary of a complicated multi-character history. You then transition your next chapter to the other, not sort of villain, but antagonist that you mentioned in the introduction. So not only do we have these secularizing liberals, but we also have Catholic modernization that you bring up in your next chapter called a Levitical City Divided. Go ahead.
That chapter is actually called The Other Reforma, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Right. Wrong finger flip. The Other Reforma. And in this chapter, you talk about the Catholic modernization project of the 19th and 20th century. And for, I would say, a lot of the literature, Catholic and modern never go together at all. So can you tell us a little bit about what Catholic modernization was and how it was playing out in Mexico?
Yeah, sure. And I'm glad you put it that way, because I think that really is something we need to rethink. And before I get into the more specifics, I think that there's a friend of mine who has definitely influenced a lot of my work, Cecilia Bautista. She's a historian in Michoacán, has talked a bit about this, the idea of what she calls concertación, right? That church and state were not, especially in the late 19th century, we can't just think of them as these sort of monolithic antagonists, but in fact, both sort of collaborated in the creation of a new kind of subjectivity, a new kind of modern subjectivity. And I think that that's what you're seeing the beginnings of here in Michoacán. Yes, there is very high level tension between church and state in Mexico at this time period. It hasn't gone away. But on the other hand, the church has decided to pivot to other kinds of strategies in its attempt to kind of regain its position in Mexico. And a major part of that strategy involves a kind of accommodation with the liberal order writ large. And so, as I portrayed in the book, when sort of Catholic restorationism, what I call, comes to Michoacán, comes to Mexico, really in around 1862. It started, of course, a bit before then, but in 1862, the church reforms the episcopate. In other words, redivides the jurisdictional boundaries of the diocese in Mexico, creates a number of new dioceses. And this is a very strategic and targeted kind of reform in which the center west is kind of targeted as an area to create new dioceses, which creates more pastoral oversight, allows for more seminaries to be created and in turn more priests to be created. Again, because this area is very, very crucial to the church. It's a kind of historic stronghold of the church, number one, but it's also a place where liberalism has taken hold in some places. Michoacán has got this really kind of explosive geography where there are, you know, it's the land of Melchor Ocampo and Epitacio Huerta, but it's also the land of people like De La Peña, the Bishop of Zamora, and La Bastida, the Archbishop of Mexico. And so this is a targeted attempt to kind of to increase the church's control in this area. So that's one aspect of it, is this kind of jurisdictional, this kind of structural aspect. The other is a kind of cultural aspect, and this is a real tightening of relations and tightening of sentiment even between Mexican churchmen and Mexican Catholics on the one hand and European and especially Roman Catholics. This is literally there are new and strengthened relationships between Mexican bishops, for example, and the Pope himself, Pius IX, who is kind of the avatar of this, what I call intransigent or ultramontane Catholicism worldwide in the period. Some of these Mexican churchmen had been exiled during the Reform Wars, in Rome. And so they had spent a lot of time literally hanging out with Pius IX, had developed more strong relationships with him, had traveled around Europe, had seen kind of what the local flavor of devotion was, what the trends in devotion were really, and tried to bring those back to Mexico. Essentially became convinced that the way that Mexico would, the church in Mexico would regain its power was by reforming its religion, getting rid of some of the more Baroque aspects, and sort of promoting this more ultramontane Catholicism. And, you know, part of that has to do, yes, with suppressing indigenous religious traditions, for example, when they fail to adhere to orthodoxy. But part of it also is the promotion of new kinds of devotional and charitable organizations. Things like the Vela Perpetua is a good example, for example, and other organizations like the Vincentian Charities. So the church is essentially offering or looking for new avenues for Catholics to be involved and to express their devotion in ways that are not tied to this older sort of Baroque model, which is based on, corporate sodalities, essentially, that's based on indigenous cofradías, that's based on entailed lands, things like that. So it's a new kind of voluntary and modern Catholicism that relies on different kinds of understandings of the relationship between earthly and divine power.
And for the next three chapters of the book, you explain how these conflicts, these interactions, these alliances between secular Catholicism or federal Catholicism and Baroque Catholicism and ultramontane Catholicism play out in the different regions of Michoacán, because like many states, but especially in Michoacán, it's divided. Chapter 3, A Levitical City Divided, this time actually the right one, talks about northwestern Michoacán and how these alliances and conflicts played out there. Could you tell us a little bit about the northwestern part of the state?
Yeah, so the Northwest is like all other parts of Michoacán, it's complicated. It's internally divided, but it is also historically a stronghold of Catholicism. It particularly becomes so, especially Zamora. Zamora is really a pole of this kind of ultramontane Catholicism. It's kind of the diocese of Zamora becomes a kind of laboratory for this ultramontane reform, So for one, it already had this kind of slower rolling tendency toward that kind of more orthodox, more ranchero, more mestizo kind of Catholicism in places like San Jose de Gracia, which has been made famous by Luis González's work, but in other places like Zamora itself. And then there's the ecclesiastical reform of 1862 really brings it home and brings and empowers the new diocese to kind of create this laboratory for Catholic reform in the Zamora diocese, which includes all of the Northwest. And so the Northwest really is it was a place I wanted to start out looking at closely, because I knew that if there were conflicts between these different strains of Catholicism, you must find it there, because there are still these historic indigenous communities in the place. There are still Afro-Mestizo communities, especially around the Lake Chapala and things like that. So zooming down to the parish level, I wanted to see how this was all playing out. And what I found was that there's certainly heightening tensions between these kind of different strains of Catholicism all over the Northwest at the time. Which is not to say, again, and I want to stress that about this chapter, it's not to say that these two factions, ultramontane and Baroque, went to war with each other literally in the Northwest, especially. The Northwest was tended to be one of the stronger religionero bastions in all of Michoacán, which is to say there's a lot of support, basically broad support among many different sectors of the population for the religionero rebellion. However, what you see when you zoom down to the parish level and then you sort of cross-check parish records with military records is that the kinds of people getting involved in the religionero revolt in northwestern Michoacán were not these kind of well-heeled, these kind of modernizing, these kind of ultramontane Catholics. Those types tended to stay out of the revolt, and they found other ways to kind of promote their new style of religion and kind of find new roles for themselves within the church through, for example, these kind of devotional associations, new modern charitable associations, things like that. But what you found was that the kind that did get involved in the revolt tended to come from this older line, kind of Baroque model. People like Eulogio Cárdenas, who is actually a relative of Tata Lázaro Cárdenas, comes from an Afro-Mestizo family of Reboceros, people who made shawls. People like that were the kind that were drawn to this revolt. And I find out, I sort of show how that's because their sort of religious leadership, their place in their communities is being quickly eroded by this new kind of restorationist Catholicism. And so even if they didn't go to war literally with each other, there was this kind of competition, right, for leadership of the local church. And I conclude that people like Eulogio Cárdenas got into the revolt specifically as a way to kind of reassert this kind of Baroque model of religion that was quickly being kind of erased. And it's also key to remember that, as you mentioned at the beginning, even the liberals, so even the most hardcore anti-clerical liberals, you know, with the exception of the few atheists or Protestants, they're all Catholics. But at the local level, in a place like Northwestern Michoacán, those people are really Catholics. The people that are working for the government, the people who are in municipal positions of power, units in the municipal government, those people are loyal Catholics and conservative Catholics, many of them. But they decided to ride out this revolt. They decided to continue, you know, serving the government through the period, and that actually sometimes did bring them into actual, you know, violent conflict with religioneros. So I really think we shouldn't play down the strength or the intensity of this conflict between these different Catholic factions, even in a place like Northwestern Michoacán, which was generally a quite conservative and Catholic bastion.
And that conflict looks different in the next region you cover in Chapter 4, which is the central part of Michoacán, where it's entitled Martyrs for Our Lord. So how did the central area differ from that very conservative northwestern area?
Yeah, it's a really interesting region that the next chapter looks at, essentially the area that was covered by the district of Puruandiro. If you look at the map of Michoacán, it doesn't really look like the center of the state, but the religioneros there actually referred to themselves as the central zone, the Gavillas of the central region. So I kind of use their terminology. What's different about the central Michoacán is a couple of things. The most prominent of which is that it belonged not to the super sort of ultramontane reforming diocese of Zamora, but to the much, much older and more tolerant Archdiocese of Michoacán. This is For listeners who are at all familiar with the history, the religious history of Mexico, I mean, this was a major area of evangelization. This is the sort of the area of Vasco de Quiroga's kind of utopian Indian hospital kind of religion. And the people at the helm of the Archdiocese of Michoacán are not nearly as sold on this kind of ultramontane model, especially not its Europeanizing trends. They don't get involved. You see, for example, that they don't get involved in many of the schemes that the Zamora folks are up to, for example, sending young students to study for the priesthood in Europe and things like that, or recruiting foreign Jesuits to come teach their priests and things like that. They're much more interested. They're much more sure about themselves, I guess, in their history. They're more invested in their own history as the inheritors of this legacy of Quirogan religion. And that makes them, I argue, a bit more tolerant when it comes to Baroque religion. They're not completely tolerant, right? They are reformers. They're kind of swept up in the ethos of the day, which is an ethos of reform. But when push comes to shove, when you read a lot of this correspondence between the archdiocese and communities, you'll find that there are these ultramontane priests that are out in some of these communities in central Michoacán don't have very much luck and don't have very much support from their archdiocesan superiors when they try to really bring the hammer down on these indigenous religious traditions and things like that. So that's one real major difference. And what I find, I look at three different communities in central Michoacan, Coineo, which is got a strong Purépecha indigenous component to it, Huango, which is a bit more mixed, a bit more mestizo, and Huaniqueo, which is also a bit more mixed, but a bit more on the indigenous side. Huaniqueo is where Socorro Reyes came from. So I knew I wanted to, he was kind of a really important figure for me. I knew I wanted to look at his community. And what I found about Central Michoacan was that there were these three very different outcomes in this one kind of zone. And those outcomes had to do with different experiences of liberal and Catholic reformism and how the different communities were able to kind of negotiate or not negotiate their religious prerogatives, either with liberals or with the Catholic Church or both. So for example, in the case of Coineo, I found that the Purépechas there mostly did not join the revolt. And that was due to a couple of things. One, that they had faced this kind of ultramontane challenge internally with their local parish priest, but they were able to sort of defeat the challenge. One by just sort of arguing for their traditions and having an archdiocese that didn't really want to alienate them, and two by negotiating with the local liberals. The liberal tradition in Coneo was very strong, and the local liberals there had it out for this local ultramontane reformer as well. And so the Purépechas kind of back the liberals and they kind of sit out the revolt. And they come out of that actually in a quite favorable position because they're able to renew their or return to their festive traditions, which get restarted there fairly quickly after Porfirio Diaz comes to power. In the other two communities, things look a bit different. So in Huaniqueo, for example, the ultramontane challenge is a bit stronger. The local land division policies there are a bit more destructive to the community because they, even though they don't completely destroy indigenous communal holding, what they do is they leave a lot of that of the communal economy intact, but they target religious properties. One of the things I found out that was really fascinating looking at the land division records for this project is that local liberals in places like Huaniqueo, other places like Chilchota, when they run up into obstacles in actually disentailing indigenous communities, which they often do, the communities can say we already did a reparto, or we're already in litigation with X or Y hacienda, so we can't do the reparto. So the repartos don't often go forward. When that happens, sometimes local liberals decide to do these more targeted strikes on religious properties, which can be disentailed as well. So they'll go after a church atrium, for example, or a church plaza used by indigenous communities for their processions. And so that's what happened in Huaniqueo. The local liberals go after local religious church properties using Ley Lerdo, and that helps to create another local rebellion there as well. And so you see in places like Huaniqueo and in Huango as well, local communities kind of rallying around Baroque traditions, usually Christological saints in this case. In Huaniqueo, we have the Our Lord of Mercy. In Huango, the Our Lord of Mercy. And in Huaniqueo, another local Christological figure that is Our Lord of Health, which is kind of the main patron of Socorro Reyes. So you actually see communities more sort of uniting around local Baroque devotions against both ultramontane challenges and liberal anti-clericalism. So you had these three very different outcomes in one sort of place, which I thought was interesting.
And then you move to an example that feels like it's almost a whole other region or country comparatively, which is the southern part of the state, in a chapter that I think you appropriately call spiritual orphans. Tell us about the southern part of the state and how this trifecta of Catholic politics intersected there.
Sure. Yeah. So Cuauhtemoc, as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, Cuauhtemoc was the first place that I encountered the Religioneros, and I encountered them through a study of land division. And so I knew from the start Cuauhtemoc had to be one of my case studies. And it's a really interesting place, and again, a very explosive place. And what I found was, I sort of assumed that Cuauhtemoc would be a place where material or agrarian issues would be the kind of most important issues, and that maybe the religious aspect would kind of fade into the background. And what I found was that, yes, the agrarian component is really, really important in Qualcomán. It does explain to a large extent why indigenous comuneros, for example, got involved in the revolt. But there was also many other factors, including important religious factors, that guided revolt in Qualcomán, and also that also influenced the trajectory and the outcomes there. Essentially, Qualcomán is this place that's very far from, it's very isolated, it's very far from everything that's happening in sort of central and northwestern Michoacán. It's mostly an indigenous kind of hinterland, but it's a place where these waves of mestizo immigrants coming mostly from the north, mostly from places like Jalisco and mostly in places like Cotija and these kind of more ranchero Orthodox communities, they're kind of filtering down into the Sierra and kind of beginning to put pressure on indigenous communal holding in it, and importantly, also on indigenous religious leadership in the area. And so the reparto, which takes place there in 1871, that really is a major trigger in the area. I talked about this already, but it was a hugely conflictual and downright fraudulent reparto in many ways. It divided the indigenous community internally. So a faction of those people went into revolt, started doing things like trying to kidnap the local alcalde and things like that. And then they got themselves involved in the Relijonero revolt. But they're only one constituency in this kind of tripartite Relijonero constituency in that area. The other one is the Guzman clan, who I found really fascinating because they actually come from a very liberal heritage. Going back to Gordiano Guzman, who was an insurgent, a federalist. So they have this history of these being these kind of liberal caudillos or liberal caciques in the Sierra. But the scions of that clan get involved in the Relijonero revolt, I argue because they've seen their influence and power eroded at the same time that the indigenous community is being eroded. Well, the Guzmans are essentially patrons of this indigenous community, and they're also seeing their standing eroded in the area. And so they get involved as well. And then there's this third constituency that comes from without, not really from Qualcomán head town itself, but from towns like Aguililla, which are towns made up mostly of this new wave or couple of waves of immigrants, mestizo immigrants coming from other places. These are much more ultramontane, much more Orthodox type Catholics. But locally in their own town in Aguililla, they have a kind of united front against liberalism. Because they don't have so much of these kind of cleavages within Catholicism. But they form this kind of temporary alliance with people like the Guzmans and the indigenous Comunero contingent under the Candidos. But I show that really falls apart fairly quickly, precisely because there are such a gulf between these different factions. So there's a major attack on the head town of Qualcomán in which the different factions all participate, but they kind of send the indigenous contingent out as infantry, and they get cut down very quickly. Many of them die, many of them get captured and ask for indulto. And the indigenous after that, and that's in early 1875, I believe, they decide to sort of sit out the rest of this conflict. They don't get too involved anymore. And from then on, it becomes more of this double constituency of Guzmans and, again, these more pious rancheros from Aguililla. And I found, so that was that's the sort of military history of the revolt in that region. And I found that there was a parallel thing going on in the religious realm, specifically that in a place like Qualcomán head town, these new immigrants have begun to demand a new kind of new standards of religious practice and style, more befitting their kind of ranchero Catholicism. And that includes doing things like, well, they're getting lands from the land division, right? This fraudulent land division. And now they want to sacralize those lands by paying individual tithes on them. So again, it undermines in both in spiritual leadership, but also in the sort of spiritual economy of the area. What was once this sort of indigenous stronghold where indigenous cofradías, for example, would have held sway, now is being really tilted in favor of these kind of pious rancheros who are amassing private property in the area and establishing stronger and stronger ties with the Diocese of Zamora.
And as clearly different as all three parts of this one state, let alone all the other states in Mexico are, by 1876, as you cover in your next chapter, Lerdismo derailed, all three of these areas have one thing in common, which is that the revolt is starting to wind down or lose some steam at the very least, until it finds an unlikely ally in the liberal Porfirio Diaz. Can you tell us how did these rebels end up working with one of the liberals of the 19th and 20th century in Mexico?
Sure. I think there's a combination of factors here. One is that although the state and federal government were having a very hard time fully stamping out the revolt, I don't think they, you know, the tide had sort of started to turn against the Religioneros a bit in late 1876. With this new approach, especially under Mariano Escobedo, again, of giving indultos, of giving these battlefield pardons to people. So the ranks of the Religioneros started to thin, especially in places like Central Michoacán, where they went back, went back to their fields, and in some places went back to their processions with the actual permission of authorities. So that's sort of happening. They're sort of weakening in some ways on that front. And on the other, Diaz presents himself as an ally to them. He actually proactively goes out and tries to recruit them. I looked at some correspondence held at the Benson Library here in Austin, in which Diaz, you can see at the beginning, he was sort of toying with the idea of sending someone like Vicente Riva Palacios to Michoacán. Palacio had this sort of experience there. He fought there during the intervention. So I think you could see Diaz thought, well, maybe this guy knows the terrain. Maybe he can help us recruit local liberals. But you can see that he quickly actually discarded that tactic and instead went with trying to recruit Religionero bands. And I think that's testament to how really how much these bands had begun to really unsettle, destabilize the local the state government of Michoacán. So he sends out, so he does this through intermediaries. You can go, there's a big collection of Diaz's correspondence edited by Alberto Maria Carreño. And you can read through these things and see the ways in which Diaz sort of recruited people to go into Michoacán and to, as one of them said, to turn the religious revolt into a political revolt. And so literally these people were tasked with going into to broker these alliances with Religioneros. And it works. There are some overtures early on, very early on in the Tuxtepec revolution period that are rebuffed. Specifically, there are accounts of approaches made to Benito Mesa, who is a kind of one of these major Religionero captains in the Northwest. And apparently Mesa rebuffed the approach because he wanted to keep the Constitution of 1824 as the kind of standard for the new political movement, which again, the Constitution of 1824 would have kept Catholicism as the official religion of Mexico. Diaz's people wanted to keep the Constitution of 1857. So it didn't happen at first, but I think as the Religioneros fortunes begin to change with this new indulto policy, they decide maybe it's time to look again at Diaz. And we don't know exactly how these face-to-face conversations happened. Maybe some of these agents of Diaz's actually offered them this idea that, well, once we get into power, maybe we can talk about softening some of these anti-clerical provisions of the laws of reform. We also know that Diaz used the idea or this tenet of municipal autonomy, which he harps on a lot, that could be seen quite clearly by Catholics of various stripes as an invitation to sort of take back local power. That is, if there's autonomy at the municipal level, that means that a municipal authority in some small town in Michoacán can decide not to enforce the laws of reform to allow people to actually continue their processions and things like that. And so Diaz has a lot of success right away at sort of converting these Religionero bands. And on the other hand, the more well-heeled Catholic conservatives in Michoacán, which is a strong constituency. There's a strong Catholic press there. Most of these people are aligned with the more ultramontane vision, but were skeptical, very skeptical of the Religioneros at first. But as this begins, this alliance begins to form between Diaz and the Relicionero bands, they begin to speak a lot more positively about the Relicioneros. And in fact, they begin to sort of champion them as people who are trying to restore, you know, the faith of the people and et cetera. And so this kind of alliance really solidifies in 1876. And interestingly, you see very immediately this kind of backlash among Diaz's liberal supporters. They can't, some of them can't believe it. You know, yourself, Ethan, expressed this kind of very unlikely, you know, this is an unlikely alliance. Well, some of Diaz's strongest kind of allies in Michoacan were also really taken aback by this. And really horrified by the fact that he would ally with some of these people, including an ex-imperialist general like Felipe Chacon. This guy is from Toluca. Diaz kind of entrusts him with coming over, you know, from the east into Michoacan, into eastern Michoacan, and to sort of like convert those people to the banner of Tuxtepec. And the local liberals there are just horrified because, you know, Chacon has this history of being an imperialist. And Diaz's response to these things is really interesting and telling. He essentially says, without saying much, you know, if you read his correspondence, he's a man of few words. And he says things like patience and trust. Essentially, just let's ride this out. You know, I know what I'm doing. We're going to use these Relicionero. We're going to use the strength of these Relicionero bands for now. We'll fix things later. I think he says at some point, any defects that you see now can be corrected later at a better time for us. And so that's what he does. I do want to stress that I don't believe that Diaz was omnipotent, that he knew that he knew this would work, that he, you know, was some sort of master puppeteer. He was kind of just responding to the events as they unfolded. But I also do think he was quite shrewd in the way that he went about this. And then in 1877, of course, early 1877, he begins to actually purge the Relicioneros. So once his power is fairly consolidated at the national level, once the Decembrista threat is taken care of, he begins to actually get rid of these Relicioneros one way or another. One way is by recruiting them. There are local forces, liberal forces that recruit some of them into their ranks. And then the other way is by sort of criminalizing them, saying that they're up to their old tactics of banditry and et cetera, and then, you know, persecuting them and including using the notorious Le Fuga, right? That report that, well, we had captured X or Y Relicionero and they tried to flee and so we shot them. And so he purges a bunch of them at that time. There is some outrage from the local Catholic press, but I argue that by that point, Catholics across Michoacan had begun to accommodate this new regime, this new Porfirian regime, and the Catholic Church itself in Michoacan also accommodated the new regime. They sort of backed off on some of their pronouncements against the laws of reform. Again, with the idea, I believe, that these differences could be worked out in a more informal way under Porfirio Diaz, that they couldn't be under Lerdo.
And that story of befriending Diaz just to maybe regret that later is a common one for the next several decades of Mexican history.
That's absolutely right.
I think, as you correctly pointed out at the very beginning of this interview, this revolt is very little covered in historiography or very briefly, if ever. What do you see as its wider legacy or impact? Why is it important to bring this back into the conversation of Mexican history?
Yeah, it's a good question. I do think so. The revolt has been given very, very short shrift, kind of in Mexican historiography generally. There's a thesis that finished just a bit before mine in Mexico on the revolt, and that's the only other like kind of systematic study of the Relicionero revolt. And what you see is that the liberal historiography just kind of dismissed it as being, you know, impotent and backwards. And even a lot of the Catholic historiography, I was surprised by some of the stuff that you'll read from, you know, sort of pan-era Catholic historians writing about the history of Michoacan, kind of dismissing this as a revolt of ignorant peasants and things like that. It wasn't really about religion and things like that. And I think that for a couple of reasons that's been that way. I think it's because the Relicioneros were super decentralized and provincialist and localist. They never really cohered into a major or a more cohesive, I guess, national movement like the Cristeros did. And they didn't really, they won some support from sort of Catholic editorialists at the end of their period, but they didn't really make very strong alliances with the Catholic elite. The Catholic Church itself actually fairly strongly condemned rebellion as a way to approach, a way to address the conflicts of church and state of the era. And so they were kind of, I think they were just seen as sort of a flash in the pan, a sort of return or an attempt or a last gasp of an older kind of conservatism, which I think is mistaken. And I think they are, again, a challenge to both liberal anti-clericalism and a challenge to Catholic modernization. And I think they are successful in some respects, in some places, for some time. For example, we see that because of this alliance with Porfirio Diaz, that the kind of church-state conciliation that unfolds in the Porfiriato allows for a real resurgence of Catholicism, both at the elite level and at the local level. We saw the return of these religious processions, for example, with the collusion of local authorities that begins to happen again in Michoacan. And so the Relicioneros really, in some places at least, were able to overturn what was then the most radical, the most thoroughgoing of anti-clerical reform in Mexico's history at the time. And moreover, this sort of informal pact, this sort of modus vivendi with the Porfirian regime, I think it goes on to play a very important role in the, not only in the Porfiriato, but in the unraveling of the Porfiriato. We know, for example, that Protestant groups especially, which become much more numerous in Mexico following, after the 1870s, they start to get really annoyed with, grumpy about the fact that Diaz has these cozy relationships with the Catholic Church. And they're going to be an important constituency in the Mexican Revolution. And so really, I argue that the Relicionero revolt and what came out of it, right, its ramifications, really kind of stunted this major secularization drive in Mexico, kind of put off a bigger reckoning with it until another generation later during the revolution and the Cristero Wars.
Well, it is a wonderful contribution to the field, and I would definitely recommend it for both Mexican historians, but also anybody that works on church history or religious history in Latin America. What can we look forward to next from you? What projects do you have going on right now or that you hope to work on in the future?
Sure. So as I mentioned at the beginning, I haven't left academia, but I'm sort of alt-ac at this point. And in my sort of day-to-day work at the General Land Office, I actually am working on a couple of different publications. Those will be of a very different nature. They're likely going to be edited volumes and compilations of translations. So for example, and they should be of some interest to historians of Latin America, I hope. The first one, which is now under advanced contract with UT Press, is a set of translations on the issue of slavery in Mexican Texas, which will be accompanied by 5 essays by scholars of Texas, scholars of slavery, scholars of Mexico. So that'll be interesting. Those are documents that we hold at the Texas Journal Land Office. They have to do with mostly tensions between the Anglo slaveholders coming into Texas at the time under the so-called impresario system of Stephen F. Austin and the like, and the Mexican government, which was trying to abolish slavery. So that's the most immediate project. Hopefully see the light of day in a couple of years. Next is another set of translations that we worked on having to do with the so-called immigrant tribes. These are groups like the Cherokees, the Choctaws, the Alabama Cushata, who come to what was then northern Mexico, now Texas, in the late 1820s and 1830s, essentially being pushed out by U.S. Removal policies, and so who come to Texas and asking for land grants, essentially from the Mexican government. Those generally don't work out, although the Mexican government is fairly favorable favorably disposed towards them at first, but for a variety of factors, it doesn't really work out. But they left this really incredibly rich set of documents in the General Land Office, which again, because it's a land-focused archive, has all these documents related to attempts to get land grants under Mexican colonization programs. So that'll be the next project, and that's a bit more further out. But that's pretty much what I'm working on.
Well, I'm excited and looking forward to reading that when it comes out. Thank you so much for your time today and for writing this wonderful book for us.
Thank you so much for having me.